You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
My name is Brett Davidson. I'm with the Public Health Program here at Open Society Foundations, and we've done a lot of work related to artistic activism. So we're very excited to have this event here, and I want to thank New York Grant Makers in the Arts and Philanthropy in New York. We've all collaborated on this event today. I think it seems like there's a lot of interest in arts and activism, so it's good to have this. I'm sure it's going to be an interesting conversation. So we'll have a panel this morning looking at what are we talking about. When we're talking about arts, creative activism, artistic activism, people will talk about some of the terminologies. And then a short break, and then we'll have a conversation about, so how do we evaluate it, and how do we know that it works, or how do we even think about what does it mean that it's working. So I think it's going to be a really interesting morning. So I'm not going to take up too much time with introductions, but I want to hand over to Steve Lambert and Stephen Duncombe from the Center for Artistic Activism to give us a short introduction about what we talk about.
Sure.
Thank you, Brad.
I like this method of...
I know. It's fascinating. It's
cool. Yeah. So, my name is Steve Lambert, yes.
My name is Steve Duncombe.
Collectively, we're the Steves.
This is the politician hand, right?
Yeah, no, this.
That?
I think so, don't they?
That's how I stole your nose.
Okay.
You should get on top. Okay. So, we are the co-founders and co-directors of the Center for Artistic Activism.
And we're a research and training institute, which is devoted to helping artists to strategize a little bit more like activists and helping activists to create a little bit more like artists.
And we started, Steve and I started working together in 2009 because we both had this question that's the thing we're going to talk about today, which is, all right, you know, I was a practitioner. Steve was coming more from an activist and academic side. I thought him as a sociologist would be able to tell me about this work and verify that it did work, right? I had a feeling that it did, but I didn't know how to do the research part of it.
Right, and I was an academic and researcher, and I had this sort of naive belief that artists were these mystical beings that could figure everything out. And so we started talking to one another, and we soon found out that we actually didn't know.
Yeah, neither of us had the answer. So we started doing research and interviewing artists.
Yeah. And so essentially what we want to do and what we're asked to do is this at the very beginning to kind of give some parameters around what we're talking about when we're talking about artistic activism. Artistic activism, of course, goes by many, many names. It's the name that we prefer, but socially engaged arts, social practice arts, political art, what have you.
And all the people that call themselves these things would tell you how they're all different.
Exactly. But it helps to have a common vocabulary. If we're going to have these sorts of conversations. And so what do we actually mean when we talk about artistic activism?
So this question and our answer sort of come from both that research and years now of workshops that we've done around the world. So we've worked with health workers in Kenya, sex workers in South Africa, activists in St. Petersburg.
And then we also worked with youth immigration activists in South Texas, Iraq veterans against the war in Chicago, anti-segregation activists in North Carolina. We're working with a whole range of activists and artists trying to kind of puzzle through this question and then put it into practice.
Yeah. So when we talk about activism, usually we're talking about
leading to an effect. I'll let you do the art. I'll do the act.
Okay,
good. Unless you want to switch it up.
Nope.
Okay. So when we talk about art and activism, they actually kind of do different work in the world. Activism, as the name suggests, is a practice of activity that is targeted towards changes in power. What the political scientist Robert Laswell called who gets what, when, and how. In that way, it's very instrumental. That is, it's something which one does in order to see an instrumental change. And as an activist, you usually know when that change has happened. A sort of shortcut to thinking about this is that activism is always looking for an effect, an effect.
And when we talk about art, those, if you tell artists, try to pin them down to a specific objective, they get really squirrely. They usually want to cover a lot of things, and it's not about a specific outcome. It's about creating a space where something can be thought about and considered in a multiple kinds of ways, but it's also about feelings and emotions and like mood. When you see a great artwork, you're moved, right? It's an emotionally moving experience. So we talk about art leading to affect or an emotional response.
Right, so when we first started to think about this idea of affect and effect, we started to come up with sort of phrases that would actually encapsulate this sort of combination.
Steve started calling it affective effect, and then he started calling it effective affect.
Yeah.
I thought both were kind of
clunky. They're both kind of clunky.
Yeah.
And so Steve had this sort of great insight, which
that's
is...
That's not clunky.
Oh, it's not. Okay. which is we combine the two. With this ash, which is an AE. We don't use it much here. They use it in Scandinavia a lot. But then the problem becomes like, well, how do you pronounce this word? Yeah.
So one way to remember it is it's I-fect. Not I-fect like this, but I-fect like a pirate.
So you're thinking about it. Now, I went to Scandinavia and started talking about that, and they said, no, it's effect. But we can't really do
but
that.
But we invented the word, so we get to decide.
Exactly. So what is artistic activism? We like to think about artistic activism as sort of the mark, the place in between affect and effect. It draws on both. That actually does have affective effect or effective affect. And that actually has and can mobilize the powers of both of those things.
But in order to clarify this middle point, we're going to talk about the edges. And then that might help this make sense. So first we're going to talk about affect. You guys know...
For some reason it's not...
Oh, no, we're good.
There we go.
So this is Richard Serra. You guys know Richard Serra? He makes big steel sculptures, right? Yeah. And this is what he looks like when he's happy. And in the mid-2000s, after the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, Richard Serra got really angry. This is what he looks like when he's angry. And he decided to make this drawing. And it was, the image of someone being tortured in the Abu Ghraib prison. And it says, "Stop Bush," really loud. Really, really big. And, he's using charcoal here. You see this that sort of anger in the way that the lines are drawn, right? He's clearly upset. And Richard Serra is a guy who's constantly drawing. Like, if you see video of him, he usually has a notebook and he never stops drawing. Drawing is the way that he expresses himself, right? How he gets his feelings and his ideas out. What he's expressing here is his feelings about politics, right? And it's not, I don't think Richard Serra had the idea that this was going to end the Abu Ghraib prison scandal or solve it. It was just him expressing his anger about it, right? And that's a way that art can work, but it has very little political impact. And what we're looking for is political impact. Steve and I call this political expressionism, right? So there's a form of expression that's expressing how I feel about, in this moment, I'm dripping paint on the canvas, and this is how I'm moving in this moment, and this is how I feel about politics in this moment. It's art with a political subject matter, not necessarily art with a political outcome.
Right. We like to think about it, it's art about politics, but it's not necessarily art that works politically. That's not to say that art about politics cannot work politically, but it's also to open the place to think that art is not necessarily about political content can work politically. But it's really the question of, is it working politically that we're interested in?
So that's one end of this spectrum, is this political expression, right? On the other side, we've got this image.
Yeah, and this is actually, we realized it was a friend of ours, so we feel kind of bad about this. But this is, if any of you are artists in the room, you've probably had this happen to you, which is someone has created or planned a demonstration, and then at the last minute they say, "Hey, can you design something for us? Can you actually make a poster that looks really good or design our pamphlet?" And there's nothing wrong with that. Good-looking posters, good-looking pamphlets are absolutely essential. But it's about bringing in art at the last minute, what we like to call
Faux finish
politics. Okay? Basically, the politics have been done, and now we're going to buff the surface with art, right? And again, there's nothing wrong with this, okay? This is actually good, but it's not putting creativity and artistic thinking into the mix from the beginning and thinking about, for example, a protest as a performance. And having artists in at that first meeting to think about what is the stage going to look like, who is our audience, what do we want that audience to think and feel and do.
and using creativity and artistic thinking to improve that, right? So I like to describe it as the icing on the cake, and what we're talking about is baking it into the cake from the very beginning.
With icing, I don't think we do that.
So at the other end of effect, you know, we've got faux finish politics. And artistic activism is actually a pretty big range in between, right? And the art is finding the balance between the two.
And literally, it is a range, okay? One of the things we're really interested in is not defining exactly what artistic activism is. And we've actually created, along with the Yes Lab, a user-generated database called Activpedia, which has 2,000 different examples of creative activism, and more actually get loaded up every single day from around the world. You can search by issue and medium and so on and so forth. And we actually don't curate it. Because we're really interested in what is the range of possibilities, and not about defining it, but instead asking that critical question. How is it effective? How is it affective? And how do they combine the two?
Yeah. So you can, this is where we're at. You can find more information about the work that we're doing at artisticactivism.org, but that's just overall like an introduction to how we think about this practice and how we define it.
But now what we're going to have is a very illustrious panel come up and talk about how they define it as well, and then how they work with this idea in their practice, and then we'll open it up to questions, and we'll go to a break, and then we'll come back for the second panel. And Brett is going to moderate this panel.
All right, so I have my egg timers here. There's a 5-minute egg timer and a 1-minute egg timer. So,
okay.
To keep time, being creative from the start. Okay. So on the panel, I have Rashida Bambre, who leads the arts exchange here at Open Society Foundation. And we'll start with Rashida talking a bit about the work that they do and how they're thinking about arts and activism, particularly in the context of human rights and the work of Open Society Foundation. And then Katie Rubin, who's with Theatre of the Oppressed, New York City, will speak actually at the end, talking about the work they're doing with theatre and participatory theatre, and particularly the Legislative Theatre Project, which is really interesting. And then we have Deborah, who's from Blade of Grass, and talking about the work that they're involved in. Yeah. So. Great. So Rashida, I'm going to also let each of you introduce yourselves more fully.
Sure.
So I'll start off with you and tell us about the work that you're doing at Open Society and the issues that you're confronting.
Okay. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So I come to the Open Society Foundations from working in contemporary art, and also being a curator, working very closely with artists, but also my own art practice as a choreographer. And I've always been very invested in some of the ideas that Steve and Steve just spoke about around what does art actually do in society. And so the Arts Exchange at the Open Society Foundations was established after the Open Society Foundations decided to close their arts and culture program, which had been running for many years and supporting Centers for Contemporary Art in Eurasia, as well as other socially engaged art practices. The reason why the Global Board decided to close that program is because they wanted to actually think about something that would work across the many programs and foundations of the Open Society Foundations, which works, I think, in over maybe 50-something countries. It's a very huge place for all of us that work here. We understand that very deeply because it takes a while to actually get to know the space. But there are many thematic programs, so like the public health program that Brett works with, the women's rights program, human rights initiative, as well as regional programs. So like the Open Society Institute West Africa, which has offices in Dakar and Guinea, Nigeria, etc., and then also the Africa Regional Office. So there are many approaches that the Open Society Foundations are taking to working on this project of human rights and social justice in many contexts. So the Arts Exchange was actually founded as a small mobile unit that would work within the strategy unit to encourage and support foundations and programs to include art in their strategies. So it's a really internal project, but it really has to think about this functionality of art, and it has to think about the way that art actually creates space for change, creates space for social justice. And so with that sort of mandate, it made a lot of sense to us to consider when I started working here about a year and a half ago with Lauren Augusta, who's helped to organize today, we started talking a lot with Brett. And Brett spoke a lot about the Center for Artistic Activism. And so because I primarily am working with grant makers, one of the things that we decided to do was to actually have a training for grant makers on artistic activism, which was really exciting. And we thought, oh, you know, this will be a way that we can actually allow grant makers to be able to identify what creative activism is and support it. But as we started to talk to Steve and Steve, it became apparent that the process of actually going through this training was also about how to infuse a certain creativity into your own work as a grant maker, and how to sort of think about, like, what are your utopic goals? How to sort of get out of the box of your own thinking, especially when you're doing social justice and human rights work. And Open Society Foundation speaks a lot about working on lost causes. So things that we know we may never win, but that we have to keep fighting that fight. And so I think within that kind of scenario, many times we never imagine, well, what would it look like if we won? What would the world look like if this were successful? And so one of the great benefits, I think, for us doing this training with grant makers, which we did last summer and which we'll do again this year, was really to think about how we can envision through creative process beyond where we're trying to go. So how can we see the blue sky, think about, like, what's the sort of most audacious way to get there, and then think about all the practical things that we're actually doing now to get there, find something in the middle, and sort of revolutionize our own work. So it was really incredible for us to go through that experience with Steve and Steve. And so, you know, because our primary way of working is actually through, I don't want to say influencing grant makers, but getting grant makers to think differently, it really makes sense for us to think about creative activism, especially for people who've never necessarily, and we have a range of grant makers who've done a lot of arts work, like we have the Documentary Photography Project, but then we also have programs who've never worked with artists, never worked with arts institutions, and so as a point of entry, I think it's really useful, and also for people who've been working for many years and need to start thinking differently, it's very useful. So I don't know if that's 5 minutes.
You have it. Yeah, it's almost 5 minutes.
Okay. Thank you, Brett. So it's been really exciting also to sort of see the light bulb go off, and especially we're in this moment, which is really extreme politically, I would say globally, but especially sitting right here, we have to think differently. We have to try new things and new strategies. And so I think creative activism is something that wherever you are on that spectrum of, like, working really closely with artists and trusting that artists, when they make this drawing, will have some political effect, or knowing that, you know, or having that recognition that we actually have to point our art in a direction of making political change, I think that this kind of work and this kind of approach is really essential and radical. Thank you.
Thanks, Rashida. So before we move on to Deborah, I just wanted to ask a couple of questions. And I wanted to ask you, what if, you know, as you've been talking to grant makers in the Open Society Foundation and talking about the role of the arts, what are some of the, I guess, tough questions that you've been asked, and how have you been thinking about them?
Well, there's so many.
I know. For example, one question that has come up, and I know that maybe it's a debate that in the arts world is kind of, it's kind of moved on. But I think often people have said, well, you know, so are you? Is there a choice between kind of politically involved, like, good art or politically involved art? You know, so, like, I know that's come up, and it's been like, and you're like, well, that's like a debate we've been having, and it's kind of moved on from there. But
yeah.
I mean, I know that's one that people have raised, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I feel really great to be, have had a career in the art world at this moment, because I actually remember that being a really large debate, maybe like even 15 years ago, where people would say, like, politically, socially engaged and politically engaged art is bad art. and it would be dismissed, you know, in many museum spaces, in scholarly spaces as well. And so I think we've come a long way since that time. And also, you know, and I think spaces like Creative Time and the Creative Time Summit, Rauschenberg Foundation, there are many people who have worked to make sure that we can sort of jump beyond that. But I think we haven't totally abandoned it. And I think it is an important question just to think about, like, well, what do we mean by good art? And how do we infuse our aesthetic sensibility with the political reality? You know, how do we sort of have an assessment that can be qualitative about art production, but also allow what it how it actually functions and what it actually does to be a part of that assessment? And so I hope that we're in a different moment with that, but I think it really means that those of us who do this work actually have to be okay educating people about that, and also bringing people into the conversation where they are, and also thinking a lot about the way in which people, because I think that one of the best ways of getting people to understand art practice is through experience. And I think people who decide to do this work that wake up and they're like, this is the only thing I can do, it's because they've had those kinds of experiences that have shifted their thinking. And so actually being willing to create those experiences for other people, I think, is a great way to sort of begin, you know, kind of deconstructing some of those old ideas around, like, political art is bad art, which I think we're in a moment now where everyone realizes political necessity. So I think it's actually advantageous, like, if there's one good thing that we can take out of, like, the rise of fascism in the U.S. in a conversation about art, is, like, most people are probably less interested in work that doesn't have a relevance, you know? Yeah. So I think that maybe that battle could be, we could jump over that just because of our reality.
And then you know, with grant makers who may be used to funding nonprofit organizations, you know, activists and so on, what are some of the issues that come about when thinking about funding artists and the challenges that I think that people have maybe not been used to dealing with artists and the particular concerns of artists or the way that artists work? Has there been some grappling with that and educating grant makers about how to actually work with artists?
Yeah, and I think that's actually one of the largest part of our job, right, Lauren, that we actually have to really infuse the necessity of trust. And I think that grant makers, especially an organization centered grant making entity like the Open Society Foundations, that really wants to give organizations more flexibility, sort of thinking of artists and artist-led organizations with that same level of, like, giving them that same level of authorship and agency. And so when we actually do co-funding with our peers, which is really a large part of our role here, is to say to other grant makers within the Open Society Foundations network, if you want to take a risk and support an arts-based practice, that we will consider co-funding that with you. One of the main criteria for that is authorship belongs to the organization or the artist. And I think that has a lot to do with this idea of, you know, I'm focused on harm reduction, and so therefore I need this to fit narrowly into my harm reduction, my idea of how that actually functions in order for me to consider it. And so I think, you know, there are ways in which some of that you have to do if you're trying to make a certain kind of change in one particular area, but I think allowing, one of the great points that's come up in many of our conversations is, like, how do we keep artists from having to shrink to fit into our strategies, and how do we create space so that artists can do what they do best and that we trust them to do that.
Mm-hmm. Right, thank you. Great. So we are aiming to have plenty of time for questions and discussion at the end. I want to turn now to, thanks very much, Rashida. I think that's really helpful to start with, to Deborah Fisher from A Blade of Grass to talk about the work that they're involved in.
Thank you, everybody, for, how loud is this? Okay, sorry. So I want to just first start by saying yes to everything that Rashida has been saying, and I'm happy to be here. A Blade of Grass is the first nonprofit that only supports socially engaged art. And in order to do that, we have a kind of interesting hybrid form. We have a philanthropic element to what we do. We do a nationwide open call every year that pulls about 500 to 600 applications from all over the country, artists who are directly enacting social change. this is an example, right? So the Ablative Grass Fellowship for Socially Engaged Art only supports artists who are working in leadership roles in partnership with communities in ways that are relevant in everyday life at an ambitious scale to enact a social change, right? So we give money, and that's a big part of what we do because artists need money to do their work, but what we're really interested in is telling stories. And let me give you some examples of art projects in order to do that. Next.
Go for it.
I'm gonna, yeah, good. I'm going to go back to that slide. That's in the wrong order. So Dred Scott is an Ablative Grass Fellow from 2015. We're supporting a project that he's doing called the Slave Rebellion Reenactment. And what he's envisioning is reenacting the very largest slave rebellion in American history with 500 African-American men and women dressed in period costumes, armed with muskets and cane knives, walking to New Orleans from a small town just north of New Orleans called La Place. In order to do, and this is something that, of course, it's obvious the meaning. Another great example, Mary Mattingly is another fellow from 2015. This is a project that everybody in New York can go and see at any time. Email me and I'll take you there. It's called Swale. It is a floating food forest. It is on a barge, and it's going to be parked just outside of Brooklyn Bridge, just at Pier 6 of Brooklyn Bridge Park. And what Mary's doing is she's imagining a world in which we grow food as a public resource together, and we don't charge for it. It's just something that we collectively manage together as a commons. So this is a barge that is a permaculture garden that you can eat the food from. This is an artist named Sala Mendy. This project is called the Journal Era Wage Theft App, and it was co-created with actually kind of a dizzying network of stakeholders that started with a photography class that she works with at a New Immigrant Community Empowerment in Corona, Queens. They decided that their biggest problem was wage theft. They developed an app together that reports wage theft, tracks data, so among a community they can tell everybody who's going to take their wages, right, so that they don't go with those people. And then this also tracks that data, and the ultimate goal is actually to change legislation, introduce new legislation around how wage theft is punished. The reason, going back to this, right, that Ablative Grass exists is because artists are changing what they want to do. I went from being an artist who made things to being an artist who made things happen. And a lot of what Ablative Grass is doing is taking this quote very seriously and saying, how does an arts organization need to change in order to support these changes in artistic practice, right? So one of the things that we're really focused on is the idea that this work is relationship-based and experiential. This is a project called Beauty in Transition by an artist named Jody Wood. It's a mobile beauty salon that operates alongside the Department of Homeless Services, and the idea is not to give every single homeless person a haircut, but to introduce a very intense, intimate experience in which the agency of the person who's getting the haircut is fully honored. Which is a very rare occurrence in an institutional context. And really, the goal is this transition, right? The goal is the relationship. So everything that we do is in service of honoring those relationships, honoring, understanding that they're not our relationships, and supporting the artist's ability to do that. We mostly do that by telling stories. We have a short film series. I'm going over time, sorry.
Yeah, I hear you, right here. You want it right there. You need to bring it maybe down here up through that. I'm willing to carry you.
artists have a relative luxury of being able to work with ideas. And therefore, I think I have a real responsibility to make work that embodies people's biggest dreams and aspirations for radical, fundamental change.
Todo el mundo tiene derecho de recibir pago por su trabajo, no importa si tiene papel o no.
Men can participate in the public conversation on violence against women and families.
Soy mujer y tengo 17 años.
Carmen, 61 años, ecuatoriana.
Carmen, transexual.
If you play as the white character, the door in the back actually opens so that you're able to leave. But for the black character, that unfortunately never happens.
What is the story?
It's about dealing with loss of a family member. You also grieve. You know, this wall doesn't separate our feelings from losing people.
Here we go.
What conversation do you want to start?
What if, like, clean water is a human right? What if food could be that way too?
What does it mean to love in a time of mass incarceration? What does it look like to engage with rage in a way that's really productive?
Like, what does greed look like? What does a complete disregard for the health and well-being of the environment look like?
If all this happens around here and nobody ever hears about it, it's like it never happened.
And now it's all gone.
This is a large part of what we do. I'm also really glad that Jan Cohn Cruz is going to be speaking this afternoon. She's the director of field research for Birdgrass. We also do a tremendous amount of ethnographic field research and storytelling about projects in the form of a book. We do amazing web content, and one of the things that we care most about is really honoring what the participants of these projects have to say, right? That is a really massively important orientation for us. This is a quote from a stylist from Beauty in Transition about why this is art for her. And when we're thinking about aesthetics and whether or not it's good art, we're looking to Nahomi and people like her to make those assessments. That's very important to us. We also do some really great public programming that's about, you know, creating experiences of our own. This is an artist named Rulon Tanjen, who's working in the Four Corners region to use movement to heal intertribal conflict and organize people around environmental activism. And again, you know, the reason that we do this is historical, right? Like, so I'm going to close it with Bertolt Brecht. The present day world can only be described to present day people if it is described as being capable of transformation.
Thanks very much. Really interesting, and to see some concrete examples, that was fascinating. So I wanted to ask you a question about, you know, you talked about this very much being an issue of relationships and artists working with communities. So what are some of the kind of, I guess, considerations of ethics and ownership when it comes to that? You know, where artists say, well, I want to work with a particular community. What are some of the discussions you have around kind of, what are the responsibilities to that?
Right. I mean, this is an incredibly important topic for us, and it's also very time consuming. So one of the things that we do in, we think a lot about how the artists are presenting themselves in relationship to these projects. How are they showing, how are they defining themselves as being the right person to do the project, right? Like, how are they owning their own subjectivity? This begins as early as a letter of interest, right? Like, so how, and we do have a really rigorous application process that involves a letter of interest, a large application, and then everybody gets an interview, because a lot of things come up in the interview that don't come up, you know, when you're not chatting back and forth. Harm reduction is a huge factor, but really it's about understanding whether or not the artist is generating and kind of understanding the concept of a stakeholder map. That's really important to us. And then understanding who the artist is in relation to that stakeholder map. And that doesn't have one answer. You know, there, Suzanne Lacey, one of the artists that we worked with a couple of years ago, did a project in Quito, Ecuador, where she was definitely parachuting in and out. But the way that she was working with existing stakeholder groups and amplifying existing activism efforts was very credible to us. Yeah, and those are that's something we asked a lot of questions about. Yeah.
And you start to get, I guess, reconsider who even gets to be thought of as an artist.
Everybody's an artist. Yeah, I mean, and to echo Rashida's point, you know, about the idea that getting training as a philanthropist in how to do creative activism became very important because we're all doing creative activism. In this work, everyone is an artist, and that notion of co-creation is baked into everybody's rehearsing for the revolution, to quote Boal, right? The idea that... So one of the things that we're actively looking for is co-creation, sharing the creative process directly with other people. That's a metric of aesthetic success for us. Yeah.
Great. Thanks very much, Deborah. So we have a kind of sequence here. We're going from grant making to a grant maker artist, and now we're going to the actual artists and the work that they're doing. So a kind of, I guess, a kind of what do you call a continuum of work here. So I want to turn now to Katie Rubin, who's been doing work with Theatre of the Oppressed, to hear about the work that you're doing, which is really on the ground here.
Great, thank you. Glad to be here also and hear everything that you're saying. And I'm going to build on that, that everybody is an artist. And we say that everybody is a spect actor, right? Not just a spectator, but an actor, so able to take action in their own lives. And that's our definition of actor. So we get a little suspicious when the audience is very quiet, like you are right now. So I'm gonna go off my own script, and I'm just gonna warm you up. Is that okay? Whether it's okay or not, I'm gonna do it. So we're gonna sing a little song. It's real quick, okay? So I'm gonna sing a little song, and you're gonna repeat back to me the opposite. All right? It goes like this: yes, yes, yes.
No, no, no.
Beautiful. No, yes, no.
Yes, no, yes.
Yes, yes, no.
No, 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 yes.
Okay, great. So now up, up, down, up.
Down, up, down.
Up, down, no.
Down, up, yes.
Down, down, no.
Up, up, yes.
All right, let's say the opposite of red is blue, because, you know. So red, red, blue.
Blue, blue, red.
Red, blue, no.
Blue, red, yes.
Red, up, blue.
Blue, down, red.
Okay. Great. That's the way we feel that we need to be in order to be ready to make collective, creative, concrete change.
Right.
A little bit confused, a little bit off our game, because we need to be able to move into something different. So this is how we work with our actors, who are everybody, and our spect actors, who are everybody. So I'll tell you real quickly what we do, and then what we're doing right now that's really looking towards concrete policy change in the city and beyond. So Theatre of the Oppressed is a methodology. It's used all over the world. It comes from the 60s and 70s in Brazil. Lúcio Boal started it. He was my teacher and a lot of other people's teachers. And then I was working as part of many teams in arts education here in New York, and felt like the way that I saw Theatre of the Oppressed as a tool being used in Brazil with institutions to make concrete change wasn't happening here in this country. Happening in a lot of other countries in a major, major way. And I'd love to chat with you about that, because I know lots of people who work in other countries. But here, it was mostly academic. And so I was working in schools, and then kind of organically got a call from a homeless outreach program saying, we've heard of Theatre of the Oppressed. We have a bunch of folks who come here every day, you know, one of these churches that has a drop-in center, who want to make a play about their experiences. So we made a play. We called ourselves the Jan Hus Homeless Theater Troupe. It was up at the Jan Hus Church on the Upper East Side. And we made a play called It Could Happen to You. And we had the first show, and we didn't know if anybody would come, right? And we had to add more chairs in the basement of Jan Hus. There were 100 and something people there. And there were all kinds of people who are part of other homeless programs, other soup kitchens, and they were all coming up to the whole group afterwards saying, can you do this at our soup kitchen? Can you do this at our shelter? Can you do this at our outreach program? And all of a sudden we had a tour. And then HousingWorks was calling us up and saying, we hear you have a play. We're, you know, we weren't us then, there was no organization, right? We hear you have a play with homeless actors, can we come see it with our clients, our members? And then started a troupe at HousingWorks. So 2011, this organization started. Right now we work with between 10 and 12 social service partners or city agencies at a time. So those include Housing Works still, Ali Forney Center, which is a shelter for LGBTQ youth, the Fortune Society, you know, a lot of these organizations, the Vera Institute, NYCHA across the city, Covenant House, and then we've also started working in neighborhoods like Sunset Park with a lot of organizations, and I'll tell you more about that. So our motto, real quick, is that our actors are anybody who wants to make a play about real life experiences in order to get to change, in order to change them. So everybody is an actor. There's no theater experience necessary. We come, an organization says, we have a desire for this. We show up. We say, okay, we do some intro workshops. People join. We make a play in like 12 hour and a half sessions. They're real raw, right? So whether that's fine art or not, it's a fascinating conversation. There, sometimes people don't come to every, well, always people don't come to every rehearsal, right? We just make the plays. And when, and on the performance days, we don't know who's going to be there, and that's how it goes, yeah? And there's no script, and it's all built on the experiences of the actors. And then, the audience. The audience is other folks at a soup kitchen. The audience is also a theater-going audience who comes to, you know, the Theater Row, or there are people who are at Astoria Library doing their homework, really different shows every time, but every time we warm them up like we did you. And then we do the play, and then we have a forum where we invite the audience to get up on stage and try out alternatives with the actors in the role of the protagonist or the allies. Yeah? And they have to try out concrete alternatives because we're not, and we don't say them. You don't get to say, this is what I would do. Mm-hmm. You have to get up and try it. Right? It's about solidarity, it's about risk-taking, it's about building relationships with people that you thought their problems were far from yours, and now you realize they're not so far from yours. Right? And that's our understanding of solidarity. Oh, shoot, okay. So we were doing that. We were doing that. And then we were doing that a lot. We were having shows all over. We had like 60 shows a year. It was really exciting, but the change was mostly on the individual or the community level, right? Because people can make a change in their own interaction with other people, and that's great, that's change. Or people can like organize and have a rally or a boycott of a racist institution, and that's change. But a lot of times we're doing these plays and they're about policies in institutions, and everybody would leave frustrated because the people who make those policies weren't in our audience because they don't want to come. So we started doing legislative theater, which is what I really wanted to talk about, but I talked too much, so I will. But legislative theater, which was, we decided we need to invite the legislators, the council members, the city agencies, the commissioners, the federal policymakers, the state senators, right, into the theater, along with the advocacy organizations and the policy experts who are working on it, and along with the communities who are facing the problems. Do the plays, have the forum, but then make policy change. So I have a video to show you how it works, and then we can talk a little bit more, or later. Go ahead.
Okay.
This is last year's legislative theater invitation video.
At the 2016 Legislative Theater Festival, we're setting social change in motion, a theatrical commotion for a political explosion. We're teaming up with veterans and LGBTQ youth facing homelessness and fighting for access to safe, supportive, and affordable housing. Together, we're building solidarity and generating policy change through interactive theater. How does it work? Check it. Watch actors perform stories about their real life experiences. The actors aren't just acting. They're real people showing you real struggles, real difficulties, real hardship, and it's our job to act out our ideas and work together to find solutions. We're not just spectators, we're spectactors. Vote on policy changes that you propose and make your voice heard by city legislators. You're in a room full of New Yorkers demanding change. You're talking to elected officials and they're listening. We need your voice and your vote. Represent.
So, can I say one or two other things and then I'll stop? Okay, thanks. The part that skipped, right, is how those policies get made. So based on the audience's ideas that people get up and try, everybody gets to write down policy proposals in their seats. Everybody has a card. And then we have this panel of policy advisors who come from community-based organizations and advocacy groups who sort them into most practical, most innovative, most popular, right? That's what we're looking for. And then they sit down, you saw Carlos Menchaca up there, you saw Ben Kalos, Jimmy Van Bramer's often there, you saw folks from HUD, Sam Miller, you saw lots of people, you saw DYCD up there. They sit down with all of them across the table. The audience is doing something else, intermission. They're quiet, it's not mic'd, and they negotiate. Are you gonna sign on to all these proposals? Right, and they negotiate for 10 minutes. And we're rushing them because everybody has to go home, right? It's 9 o'clock. And then all those council members get up with all these policy advisors up on stage with the actors and they say, okay, these were the four top proposals that you wrote based on the problems in the plays, based on the improvisations on stage, and now we're gonna take a vote. You saw the green and red cards everyone has in their programs, right? And people are allowed to express dissent, ask questions, we make amendments, right? Mini political process right there. So obviously in terms of impact, civic engagement, building relationships with those politicians, but we've also seen laws be changed because of this process, right? Because of this process, we changed how the NYCID was going to mark gender or actually allow people to leave that blank, which was radical, so that low-income New Yorkers who had IDs that didn't match their gender who were getting arrested, right? And processed, were getting harassed, I mean, all kinds of things. Because of that, the problem of not being able to get the correct ID was changed through the NYCID because in 2014, Carlos Menchaca was there and he was sponsoring that bill and he was writing it right then. So there's other examples of that that are happening all the time.
Okay. Thank you so much. So just a quick question for you before then we open it up to the discussion. I asked Rashida, around thinking about how grantmakers interact with artists. What are some of the issues that you face dealing with grantmakers that you wish they would think about?
I mean, I will say, I have to give a shout out. We are a new grantee of the David Rockefeller Fund this year. And it for a particular purpose that, they called us up and said, what's the project that will help you move forward? And in asking that question, I realized that what we need to do and they also said, which was interesting to me, our priority is to prove the power of artistic practice on concrete civic change, something like that, right? And I said, oh, that's great, because I want to do that too. And then we thought, well, this is our fifth year of legislative theater coming up May 7th through 13th. You should all come. And we have never had any official way to document all these concrete changes. And I just have these anecdotes, and we have all these council members who can talk about it, and they do, but what if we could, write a paper, do a case study, and show all of you? So that is really exciting to us. It's a great way to celebrate. This is our fifth year of doing this. Yeah, and we're a young organization since 2011, really. So that's one way. And that has sparked in me, or has continued a lot of thinking about not enough funders, or here there are a lot of funders, but we find it's still really rare, funders who understand the power of what North Star calls innovative activism, right? We've been a North Star innovative activism grantee for 3 years, and at the beginning I was like, wow, how come this is the only innovative activism program, and it's not that much money, because that's how they work, which is fine, but you know what I mean? How come I don't have 6 innovative activism funders? So those are some thoughts.
Thank you. Okay, so I'm sure there are many questions, many points people would like to make. So I'd like to open it up to everybody. Let's have some spectators now, some participation. Questions for the panelists or just comments that you'd like to make or questions that you have. We'll start over there. Yeah.
Hi.
Could you use your microphone as well?
With the Rocco Fund. Thank you for the kind word. In Darren Walker's really eloquent defense of the arts 10 days ago, he said, without art, there is no empathy, and without empathy, there is no justice. And I thought, what a powerful statement for in support of arts for activism. And my question for any of the three of you is, to what extent do you see empathy as sort of a powerful, emotional, compelling emotional experience in much of what you do? Just because Because the challenge of writing about this and talking about it is really one after 2 years that keeps coming back to us. We're looking for the words and the concepts.
So let's take a few comments or questions and then we'll come back to the panelists. Anyone?
Good morning, everybody. Good morning. I appreciate everything everybody said up there. So I'm not sure if this is like...
Introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm Stephen Pacheco of the David Rockefeller Fund. Sorry about that. So all three of you work in respectively different areas, so to speak, but there's area of overlap, obviously. So I was wondering, have either of you maybe considered, or do you know that it's possible that, just we'll take you three because you're on the panel, could collaborate in the things that you do to kind of influence the field of philanthropy to kind of do something similar to what the Theater of Oppress does in terms of on the opposite end of the spectrum and how we create grants and things of that nature. Does that sound like something that's actually feasible, realistic, and does that sound like something would be interesting to the three of you?
Yes.
All right, well, let's take those, let's deal with those two, and then hopefully some other people have thought about questions or comments here. Debbie.
I actually like the way these two ideas work together, right? I mean, and I came to A Blade of Grass through managing philanthropy, right? Like, so yes, the short answer is yes. Philanthropy is a very creative act, right? It's, And one of the things that is very difficult is how do you tell an evidence-based or interesting or credible story about making something happen that doesn't exist, right? I mean, it's exact, like you could say that it's exactly like making a sculpture. You want to take something, you want to make a change happen in the world. You want to make something that doesn't exist right now. And so one of the things that I think is really interesting, and just in a very grounded way, is the idea that open society has already been, kind of taking Steve's classes. Like, that's I'm on the board of Center for Artistic Activism, so I will shill for them, absolutely, and support. They're great, and I've taken those classes as well. I think that they're Steve's workshop, Center for Artistic Activism workshop, changed the way that I think about philanthropy in a very direct way that I took back to my jobs, and I used it to help make A Blade of Grass, right? So, like, what you're suggesting exists, right? And one of the things, Lucas, that really helped me the most was really thinking about this in terms of direct relationships between people and telling credible stories that are really much more anecdotal and ethnographic in nature and much less about trying to define generalizable data or try to make a case, right? Because the moment you try to make a generalizable case about something, you're abstracting the rich tapestry of human experience that makes all of this work. You know, it's like taking a vitamin instead of eating food. Yeah.
I was also really moved by Darren Walker's mm-hmm. talk, and I'm so glad that they sent it out to all of us who were not in the room in the Kennedy Center. I was saying earlier that I think a lot of our work actually relies on experiential kind of spaces and moments, and especially, and that's actually just, really narrowly trying to encourage grant makers to think about the way that art functions. So like, for example, the Belarus Free Theater, based in Minsk, in Belarus under a dictatorship, the artistic directors are actually functioning in exile in the UK. And they were actually here in January for the Under the Radar Festival. And it was incredible because the way that they function in Minsk is that they're operating like in people's living rooms, in an extremely underground kind of context. So like in living rooms and garages, et cetera, they have to go get the audience members in small groups and bring them because the audience can also be arrested for participating, which actually the company two members of the company were actually arrested late last week. But one of the things that Under the Radar Festival did was to actually present the work in this small space within Tisch at NYU. Mm. And what they said as an introduction was like, we understand like that in the US context, this may have seemed you know, really foreign at one moment in time. But I think now that you have Trump as your president, and you think about like what it looks like if you could envision, like we talked about utopic vision, but maybe like dystopic vision, right? Like if you could imagine what your life could be and how your creative activists and your artists who have political directives will have to function. We wanted you to experience this play the way we experience it in MITS for that reason. And I think, you know, one of the main functions of that is empathy. Like one of the main functions of that is like experiencing what someone else's life is like, right? And therefore envisioning like not only how you can support that, but how you can work actively against that kind of reality in your own, like work for justice. And then to the point about collaboration, I think that this event today is actually one of those intentional kind of collaborative efforts that, you know, we were we work with Center for Creative Activism, and you know, like Deborah and Katie, but also have a relationship to them. So we're thinking about like how can we have this conversation together, and bringing in like Sarah Reisman and Risa. So I think that we just have to keep continuing to be intentional and like all of us in this room be creative about how we can work together. I think there's, you know, so much possibility there.
Yeah, I think it's all been said. I just think that in terms of the collaborative piece, that there is a ton of collaboration happening among nonprofits. For us, the most exciting collaboration towards concrete social change is often not with arts organizations. In terms of making the change, right? Because that's how we need to partner, you know, with the Bronx Defenders and with the, you know, Center for Creative Innovation, and then, you know. But I also think that as everyone's been saying, so many arts institutions are thinking about this now, even in a way that they haven't been before. And so there's constant collaboration. Like if we're presenting our work at BRIC, we're collaborating there towards this same purpose, and they're giving us the space. So I think there are lots of opportunities for grantmakers to hear about those collaborations by just popping into those events, you know, and sort of speaking with people. Yeah.
Can you remind me of something that's, you know, definitely a feature of the way that A Blade of Grass works financially, right? Your core collaborations are with non-arts organizations, right? Like, and so that idea, and Rashida, you were also talking about the notion of art and, right? Like, and so, you know, that is a core innovation. That is a very creative way to think about grant making, which is typically quite siloed, right? Like, so really, you know, how might that be expanded upon or better understood, right? Like, so, you know, David Rockefeller Fund, we're honored to be working on a criminal justice fellowship that weighs, you know, two different kinds of effect, you know, artistic effect and creative and criminal justice equally, right?
Right.
Yeah, so how might those be expanded
and
better understood?
Yeah, and those collaborations, I mean, like, we have kind of Laundromat Project and Groundswell on our speed dial, right? So they're doing the same kind of work we're doing. So we're talking all the time. And we are passing funders between us. You know, I'm part of a sisterhood of seven nonprofit EDs who are not all arts and some are. And we're constantly introducing people and passing funders and passing resources and sharing board members and all kinds of amazing things. So, like, I think there's lots of ways for, for funders to just, like, pop in and see how those things are happening. That they are happening and they are growing our impact exponentially, and we're doing them ourselves because we have to.
I'll just say something from I guess a little bit the other side, where a lot of the work that I've been doing with the Center of Artistic Activism is trying to train activists in using the creativity and embedding the creativity in their work, and I realize that an important part of that is actually participating in that as well, so being there and being part of the workshop and having them see that the funder is supportive of them being creative and doing some outlandish things. Because I think it was like, well, this is a great idea, but who's going to fund us to do that? I'm like, well, I'm here. That's why I'm interested in this. I'll fund it, you know. So I think that's actually being part of that and showing that we're actually really trying to also concretely behind them, like pushing the envelope a bit and being more creative.
Yeah, and can I ask a question about that? Yeah. So then what are the stories that you are telling back at OSF to increase, you know, legitimacy and to, you know, kind of tell the stories that increase, that ripple out past your circle?
Yeah, so I constantly come back and said, yeah, we've been doing this thing.
Yeah.
A good example is, and what we found actually is in that kind of thing, a one-off training is fine, but it's actually more effective if you then provide ongoing mentoring and support over a longer period. And one of the most successful has been in South Africa with sex workers who are working on kind of campaigning for decriminalization of sex work in South Africa. And so there was a workshop there, and then a year later, Steve went and spent a month with them ahead of the AIDS conference in Durban last year. And they then introduced a whole lot of things during the AIDS conference, which made a whole lot of impact and got a whole lot of news coverage, and including an award in which they invented an award for Elton John, and then eventually got to meet him and gave him the award. So, and then this was highlighted in a news article as like the 10, like one of the three of the 10 stunts that really got media attention in at the AIDS conference. And then other groups now came to that organization who were working on all sorts of other things and said, wow, how did you do that? Can you teach us to do this? You know, and we're feeding that back to our colleagues here. And they say, well, how do you know it works? I'm saying, well, look what happened in South Africa. Here's the video. Here's the in the feedback. So, yeah.
So the metrics that, or just like the outcomes that help you tell a better story are the news coverage of that event,
For
example.
Well, for
like
example.
I'm just trying trying to isolate like what's effective in helping you move your needle. That's that's interesting to me.
And the reports from the activists about what how the impact it's had.
Can I like just
as
one of the things we did in South Africa was at the beginning of that meeting with the organization was like, what do you want to achieve at the AIDS conference? And they made a list. And so one of the markers for us was everything on that list got crossed off. And so to be, for them to say, like, we were trying to do this, and then we did it. Mm-hmm. And for them to set the goals, too, was also an important part of it.
Great. Okay, so we have another question.
All right. Hi, I'm Bethany Hall from the Atlantic Philanthropies. And my question's about audience. And in some cases, it's really clear who your audience is. In others, not so much. And I'm really curious about who you're trying to reach. And I would say that, like, it seems like in some cases you're trying to reach people kind of within the community or within the choir. But I'm wondering if and how you try and reach people kind of outside and how you go about doing that.
Is that okay?
Go.
I would say, the secret goal that we have of legislative theater is for legislative theater to become part of the city's and greater and other political bodies' processes, right? And we've seen that start to happen. So our goal, for instance, is when Jimmy Van Bramer calls us up and says, we have a hearing about homelessness, can we have a performance as part of the testimony? Right? Or Writers Alliance, right, which is a advocacy group, calls us up and says, we have a rally on the steps of City Hall about the Fair Fares Initiative, the low-income MetroCard, half-price MetroCard for low-income New Yorkers. Can you come to a scene? And then they get a ton of press because it's theater and it's funny and it's creative, right? And it's not just a bunch of council members. Or then we had these folks who've come every year from HUD. They love legislative theater at HUD, although those people don't really make any policy, but it's interesting, the federal government's so fascinating, but they I've been learning a lot. So then they brought us into 26 Federal Plaza with the Ali Forney Troupe for an interagency performance. We had HUD, we had SAMHSA, we had DOJ, everybody there, right? Mm-hmm. So there were like 70 staff people who are 100 feet from their desks, and we did a mini legislative theater session there with the Ali Forney Center Troupe, with the actors saying, okay, what policy are you going to go back to your desk for right now and advocate for based on the conversation? And they're having a debate between them in the forum, right? Oh, we could do this. And somebody else says, oh, but if we did this, right? Which is exactly what we're trying to make happen. Yeah. So, and then Carlos Menchaca, the council member, has been bringing us into his neighborhood to do work where there's a pop-up Theater of the Oppressed troupe made of intergenerational, three languages, all, the whole neighborhood can be there, that can then be at a town hall when there's a really contentious issue, like lack of school seats, and everybody's angry, and instead it starts with a forum theater event. So those are the ways that we want this to be a tool for the change makers, as opposed to us begging the change makers to come in to our audience.
Yeah.
Can I also?
Go.
So, I mean, for me, talking about audience, I think one of the benefits of the creativity and artistic activism to me is finding a way for activists who've been doing all sorts of kind of traditional activism to reach beyond the choir and to reach other audiences beyond the people that already support them. And I think it's been a very effective way of doing that. And that's part of the brainstorming process, you know. So, and I think of one example when we worked in Macedonia with LGBT activists and decided to stage an event in the main park in Skopje, the capital of Macedonia. And, you know, and we created this, it was the idea to create this kind of utopia of Macedonia with its own borders, etc. And you know, something that they'd never thought to do before. And everyone who was in the park came through and got the material and kind of, you could just see them kind of, their eyes light up with this kind of scene that we created. And they, you know, and in 2 hours in that morning, I think we handed out 500, like, this, we created this kind of alternative passports for Macedonia, 500 of these things, you know, and to people that they would never have reached otherwise. So I think to me, well, that's one of the benefits is helping activists through creativity reach out far beyond the kind of choir that already supports them. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I would say that a Blade of Grass is trying to reach two different audiences, and they need really different things, right? Like, so one of the audiences that we're really looking at is like really like a broad research-based creative, like people who do creative placemaking, grant making, love what we do, because it helps them understand, especially the research angle, it helps them understand how to work at the artist scale as opposed to the, you know, city scale, place scale, you know, so that's an audience that we know how to work with really well. We give them tons of information and we answer questions about how artists work in communities, right? Another audience that we're really tapped into very easily is just like a broad, you know, just like popular audience. We make short movies for social media. Upworthy and Atlantic Magazine have taken our films, you know, like they have tons and tons and tons of views, you know, by a non-art audience that, you know, may or may not even recognize that this is art. It's a cool story that takes 5 minutes to watch on my computer, you know, like, so that's another really easy audience. An audience that kind of comes to us a lot that's kind of confusing is the art world. Right, like we don't know what to do with the art world yet. We're working on it, you know, like, because we're looking at what makes good art differently, right? Like, and because we're looking at we have different metrics of success, right? But at the same time, I mean, it was wonderful to work on a project with the New Museum, you know, last year with Simone, which you participated in quite a bit, Rashida, right?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, you know, so I mean. Yeah, we're still figuring that out. But yeah, accessibility is a big feature of this work. So that makes audience really easy.
So it's sort of an...
Can we introduce yourself?
Questions. Oh, I'm looking at the side. I'm Vicky Besai, and I teach at New York University in the Department of Art and Art Professions and sort of direct the art and education programs. And so my question is sort of expanding the audience to art teachers. I also train K-12 art teachers who still are very locked in this particular way of understanding art. They do believe in social justice art, but social justice hasn't what Steve's talked about as political expression. Instead of moving the high school students particularly and middle school students who are really interested in justice and, you know, that's, you know, to sort of get them to think about how they could use their own agencies to create change and sort of work within this legislative mode or other modes. And so just your thoughts on how one sort of expands some of that, because it is really, our teachers are very locked into still object making, which is good, which is fine, but you know, how do we get them to sort of move to think about it on a spectrum, that they can do object making, but also do, you know, work that actually impacts their students' lives in real ways.
Any other final questions? Because I think we should take a final round of answers. So Sanjay, the last, and then we'll have responses and wrap up and have a break.
Hi, Sanjay Patil from Open Society Foundations. This is a question more for the grantmakers, but I'd be really curious to know what Katie thinks as well. What are some strategies for scaling up some of the things we've been talking about? So when I'm hearing Katie speak, I'm thinking, like, Theater of the Press should be literally in every city, in every major urban center, and it's probably not, unless I'm mistaken about that. But so just what are some effective strategies for scaling up this kind of intimate but effective method by which art can have impact?
So let's just start, Katie and Rashida, and we'll move on to you.
I mean, look, when you say that, I get all stressed out because we're sort of operating on, you know, four staff in the office when we're lucky, mm-hmm. you know, and most of us are also facilitators because that's how we understand our work to be. So I'm, you know, running from show to grant to, you know, whatever. And we work a lot in the rest of the country, actually, because there is not this kind of thing in the rest of, again, the U.S. in this way, right? So we have been sending our people out to do PDs, sort of to answer your question, with teachers and universities and organizations and, you know, communities that are already organized around a crisis, like in St. Louis or, you know, whatever, a lot. And we find that there is a need for scaling up, and people want support to build these kinds of, you know, what the structure that we've built here through, you know, just kind of grunt sweat. I, you know, this is where, you know, our organization is full of artist activists. I did not go to school to know how to run a nonprofit, and this is where we need help. This is where we need to sit down with somebody. I'll say even the work of, you know, all these responding to political, the council members who call us and the organizations, we have no money for that because it's responsive. We don't plan it. I need somebody to say, here's $50,000 for all the things people are going to call you to do in the next year that we can just pay our people to be there, because every time somebody's like, can we go to this thing in City Hall, and I have to go, can we pay our jokers, our facilitators, can we pay our actors, do we have enough Metro cards, every time. And sometimes we don't. And that's a bummer, because that's exactly what I think we should be doing. So I really have no idea, but yes.
I just wanted to say quickly that it's actually an opportune time because the city is now developing a cultural plan. So they're developing a plan for New York City, and it's the first time that they're actually doing it. And it's going to be a 10-year plan. And so it actually is a great time for us all to get in there because there is an opportunity for us to be heard. Mm-hmm. So I think that is a direct avenue that's happening. Yeah. And you can just Google Create NYC.
So for the question about teachers, even though I'm speaking outside of my role here, when I worked on a project with Creative Time, it was called Funk God, Jazz, and Medicine, Black Radical Brooklyn, we did a project with Zenobia Bailey, who I think she also became
we love Zenobia.
One of your grantees.
Yeah.
And the project was with the Boys and Girls High School, which, you know, was a failing high school in terms of, like, their test scores, et cetera. And one of the things that Zenobia spoke about was this idea of the aesthetic of funk, the African-American aesthetic of funk, and how when she went to design school, she actually didn't see all of the approaches to design that she found in her own home with her mother and her grandmother that were like functional design. And so she wanted to actually work with the students in their art class, with their art teacher also, to develop their design skills. And she said, like, they were natural designers and they were brilliant. And she just sort of gave them a platform. Mm-hmm. A year later, after the show, the Creative Time Summit happened there, and it was about curriculum. And many of the students that had worked with Zenobia were there and asking really critical questions of the audience, of, like, socially engaged art people, artists, activists, what are you going to do with us? Like, how will you work with us beyond that? And I think that project, like, having them participate in the socially engaged process also opened to critical thinking and, like, you know, their understanding of, like, what was due to them as citizens, right, and also as citizens in that high school, in that neighborhood, where so many people show up for all kinds of things. So I feel like socially engaged art practice is a great way of working with young people. And then for the audience, was that?
Yeah.
Scaling up.
Oh, scaling up, okay. It was interesting because when I came to work at Open Society Foundations, there was a project that they had made a case study film about Jeanne Rapé, which is essentially the news coming out of Dakar by two rappers, KT and Human. And they've done it, they do it in Wolof, so that it's also accessible for many people who can't access the news if they don't speak French, et cetera. One of the things that's been amazing, like in the past year and a half, is they've actually gone to other contexts throughout the continent of Africa and worked with other hip-hop artists to develop their own news stations, which will be like also using hip-hop in various contexts. So I think there were like 5 or 6 countries the last time we checked. And so I think like with Theater of the Oppressed, if you have folks who actually want to be trained in things, and I think the same thing with what Center for Creative Activism is doing, we also are going to work with them this year in this idea of training trainers. So like some of the sex work activists will be training to be able to train other people. So I think, you know, as in philanthropy, obviously we can support these kinds of initiatives with projects that we see are incredible, and not that they work the same way in a different context, but that we can think about how, you know, folks in that context can then reimagine it for the work that they're doing.
Yeah, getting back to the K-12 education, I want to echo, Zenobia's experience with Boys and Girls High School is very interesting in terms of this. You know, another thing that's kind of interesting is changing the way that we talk about what art is and what it's for, right? There's an amazing book that I think everybody who's in this room should pick up, or like you can even like just Google it, and they have like poster versions of this. It's called The 8 Studio Habits of Mind. And it's a way to talk about art in terms of what it does as a practice that doesn't necessarily reflect on object making, but it reflects on how it builds critical thinking skills. And I won't go into details about it, but it's super useful, and I use it all the time. It's a way to talk about from like a very personal level how art making builds things like the ability to be frustrated, or the ability to fail and things like that, right? Scaling up is a really important it's what keeps me up at night. So one of the things that I would like to see is a world in which artists, like a lot of the artists who are doing this kind of work, don't need like grants, they need like jobs, and how does that get embedded into the way that we think about art? What is art, who is it for, and what does it do, right? Why don't all town halls have a Theater of the Oppressed format or a similar format, right? Like if corporations are people, why don't we have a CEO of conscience in every single organization who is an artist and a shaman, you know, like, and who's responsible for making moral decisions and meaning-making decisions in those contexts? You know, I mean, there are tricks in implementing this, of course, because then, you know, once you're inside of an organization, you become, you know, kind of a slave to its goals. And artists work better when they are outside, right, of those goals. How we solve those problems doesn't mean like that artists should be poor and struggling to make Metro cards happen. It's more about like how do we define that job description, right? And how do we organize, a chain of command, right? Like so something kind of more like that. The Department of Cultural Affairs in New York City, in addition to the cultural plan, has been doing really amazing work integrating artists into city agencies through a pilot program that we are really honored to be doing evaluation work on. Jan, I'm sure you'll talk more about that. And and really amplifying that work and making it into curriculum, right? So, and not necessarily curriculum for artists, although that's important too. Not every artist knows how to interface with a government agency, right? In the PEAR program, even, right? Like, but really, who needs to be trained here, right? Like, it's the city agencies, it's the people who are making those job descriptions, it's the people who are, you know, who are kind of making those decisions about what's valuable, right? Because every single project that we're excited about here is about changing the way that things are valued in the culture. Right, you know, and if we value different things, then the money flows because we value it, right? So instead of kind of keeping it in this realm of like nonprofits exist because these things aren't valued, I guess I'm asking philanthropy, what is philanthropy doing to change the values?
So thank you. I think that's great that sort of pointed which to end this panel. And can we have a round of applause for our panelists?